All right, good morning. Great to be back and share another session with you. For those of you who haven't been in my sessions before, I should give you a bit of a warning. They're a bit loaded towards church history. They're a little bit more perhaps like a lecture than the sermons that you're used to. And really they might startle you to hear this, but I'm actually aiming at presumption and superficiality in what I present. Okay. Because I've realised that what I'm covering is usually such a vast amount of material in a short period of time that I'm presumptuous to do it. And therefore I'm covering it at a superficial level, which I've decided to make a goal rather, you know, now that I'm confessing it, I might as well admit it's a goal, because what I'm doing in that is actually relying on God to make something stick. So we're going to run through, you won't remember all this, I probably won't remember all this, but let's just trust that God can use presumption and superficiality this morning, shall we? And see where we go from there. Okay. We start with what's probably quite a scary photograph of you. Can actually see it. But before we get into this, I'm going to use a few minutes productively. Some of you in previous sessions have seen I've done this church history quiz. Okay. I bribe you with chocolate, basically, which ensures that you stay awake for the next 15 or 20 minutes. And it's good to be here with Steve again this morning. Steve and I go back to the 90s, studying at what's now VOS together. So, sorry you're here this morning, Steve, to hear me confess that I'm being... You know, the VOS deserves better, I know, but okay. All right, so we're going to give you three multiple choice questions. You just have to decide A, B, C, or D in your mind, then be honest, and depending on how many you get right, you may or may not get a Milky Way in a few minutes. Okay. All right. The Council of Elvira, E-L-V-I-R-A, in the Middle Ages, required a three-year excommunication if a man broke off an engagement. This is as in a marriage engagement, not a business engagement. What was unusual about that penalty? A, a woman who broke off an engagement only got 6 months excommunication. B, the man was not excommunicated, his parents were, presumably for bringing him up improperly. C, the man's excommunication ended if he married a different woman, but not the same one. Or D, it was the only council in church history allowed to prescribe penalties that was led by a woman. Okay, I'll give you those quickly again, then make up your mind. So what was unusual about the three-year excommunication? A, a woman who broke off an engagement only got 6 months. B, the man wasn't excommunicated, his parents were, because they didn't do a good job. C, the man's excommunication ended if he married a different woman, not the same one. Or D, it was the only council in church history allowed to prescribe penalties led by a woman. So, make up your mind. And here's question two. All right, who has a well-developed theology of cutlery? Hey, someone over here. Excellent, excellent. So it may, you know, you may not have lain awake at night wondering when was the table fork invented. But you're about to find out. It was invented in the 11th century. But after it was invented, for nearly 100 years, ministers preached against them. And the question is why? Okay. So A, was it A, because the devil had a forked cloven hoof? B, since food comes from God, it should only be eaten with instruments created by God. In other words, your fingers. Not sure how that works with soup, but anyway. C, legend said that Eve had reached into the tree with a pitchfork to get the piece of fruit. Or D, the first forks had only two tines, pointy bits, which was considered an unholy number. After they added a third tine, everything was okay. All right, so your options. A, the devil's hoof. B, not created by God. Instruments should be created by God to eat with. C, even the pitchfork. Or D, the number of tines. And our last question for the morning is... Okay. Are we doing communion this morning? Oh, okay. This is safe then. Which of the following has not been a communion issue over which Christians have killed one another? Which of the following has not been a communion issue over which Christians have killed one another? So, sadly, that means three of them have been. Okay? So which one hasn't been? A, should people get both the bread and the cup or just the cup? B, should bread or a cracker be used? C, have we had a power failure? C, does the bread contain Christ's body or merely represent Christ's body? Or D, may white grapes be used or must they be purple grapes, as in Palestine? Okay, which one didn't they kill each other over? Should it be both bread and the cup or just the cup? Should a bread or a cracker be used? Does the bread contain or represent Christ's body? Or D, the colour of the grapes? Okay, now, without having given my wife Deborah any notice at all, I'm going to get her assistance here. Who got three right? Oh, look! This is the Holy Spirit morning. Don't you know the answers? Okay. All right. Okay. Question one. The one about excommunication. Correct answer was B. They excommunicated the parents. Okay. No. We've got to wait and see how many they got. Okay. The one about tableware, the correct answer was also B. Food created by God should only be eaten with instruments created by God. And the final one was... Okay. The final one was communion issue. The one that they didn't kill each other over was D, the colour of the grapes. Did anyone get three right? Did anyone get two right? All right, we'll start off distributing to the twos. I think we'll have a few Milky Ways. How many got one right? Oh, we might be able to carry it over to the ones there as well. You know, I'm sorry for those of you who got two right. You know, remember that parable about the labourers and the wages? And, you know, sorry, we're referring to that one. Okay, well, while Deborah's doing that. None right? Okay. So this morning, we're going to talk really briefly, really superficially, and very presumptuously about the origins and the rise of Pentecostal and charismatic movements. For those of you who can't see, it looks like there's a young blonde girl being attacked by a bunch of guys there, but really I think they're praying for her. Okay, so we're going to look at some of the background of the Pentecostal movement and then look at some of the influence. Firstly, we need to understand what cessationism is. So the whole idea of the Pentecostal and charismatic movements was that there was really a restoration or intensification of these the charismatic gifts, so-called things like tongues, prophecy, healings, miracles, etc. One of the prevailing views had been for some time that they had ceased. So essentially that they were given for a certain period of time in the early church, they ceased, and any claim to the gifts after that had to be either something that was a con job or something possibly demonic. And normally that was seen as happening at the end of the apostolic age or thereby, that this was something, those gifts were necessary perhaps to get the early church on its feet. Once the scriptures were there, then these gifts were seen by some as having completely finished. Now, there's a whole interesting survey that can be done as to continuity of these gifts through the Middle Ages, and we're not going to really go there today for the sake of time. I am putting some limits on my presumption, not many. So we're going to jump centuries here and start looking at the 19th century. So most of you are probably aware that, and certainly aware in this congregation, there'd be people who've got all sorts of opinions on here this morning on the whole Pentecostal charismatic movement and validity of gifts, etc. And we're not really going to try to assess that this morning. So we're going to look at it historically in the lead-up in the 19th century to what's seen as the beginning of the modern Pentecostal movement early in the 20th century. Many of you would know that the Wesley's ministry through the 18th century left a very wide legacy in the British Isles of camp meetings, and that was something that was... Sorry, outdoor evangelism and camp meetings coming also from this first and second Great Awakenings in America. These were what we might think of as... the term usually used in America is awakenings, and in England is revivals. Sometimes these are involving laity. They're often outside the boundaries of the established church parish. We've got people like Charles Finney, Dwight Moody, and Timothy Dwight, Yale University. Lots of interesting things to look at here, which we're just using as touch points to say that there's some interesting background to Pentecostalism. And coming out of all this unusual Christian activity that moved beyond the boundaries of the parish, it built up an expectation that maybe, just maybe, God can move outside the boundaries of the of a parish, the four walls of a church, which surprisingly perhaps to many of us had been a view that had been held throughout much of the Middle Ages. God will hear the prayers of certain holy people, but not the everyday person. God will hear the prayers in a church, but not necessarily anywhere else. The idea of preaching outside of a church that was instituted by Wesley Whitfield and others was seen as scandalous in that particular time. So there's a stretching of the limits of where God might move. Throughout those awakenings and revivals, there had been lots of different types of manifestations in these meetings. But it's fair to say that a lot of them had centred, if you like, on people's overwhelming emotional response to realising the gulf between a holy and transcendent God and where they were in their sinfulness. There had been very strong reactions to that. But as the 19th century continued, there was also a strong stream that was starting to focus on divine healing, the fact that God might move in a miraculous way to heal people. The 19th century saw millions of people literally coming to Christ. The Second Great Awakening is quite an amazing event or series of events starting in the 1790s with a series of camp meetings in Kentucky, so reaching a rural area in the southeastern part of the United States, but simultaneously a revival on the campus of Yale University. And also the Baptists were known as, you had the Methodists and the Baptists were particularly prominent in this revival. The Methodists, as any of you would know who've looked a little bit at the life of John Wesley, loved horses. Baptists, it seems, were allergic to horses, but they were good farmers. So they would have, the Baptists had farmer preachers, so you farmed an area and you would preach, and the Methodists had their circuit riders who would cover an area and shared the gospel that way. The Second Great Awakening rolls on through really into the 1820s at least and perhaps beyond. There was another, that 1859 revival, which was on both sides of the Atlantic, saw a lot of key ministries come to the fore, ministries that you would know, people like David Livingstone and the YMCA and William and Catherine Booth. These were people who were converted through this period of time in the middle of the 19th century, and their ministries flowed on into the 20th. All of these things convinced people that God was moving in different ways. Now, there's an interesting woman by the name of Phoebe Palmer coming out of a Wesleyan background, and if any of you know a little bit about Wesley, the idea of sanctification was something that he developed in an interesting way. And Phoebe Palmer took that in another direction and said, hey, if you consecrate yourself to God, you can become fully sanctified at that moment. Okay? Which made sanctification more of an experience than the process that many of us are used to. In the second half of the 19th century, holiness circles, building in some ways on some of Palmer's thoughts, started to think, well, maybe there's something else. Maybe there's something, a third thing. We've got conversion, we've got sanctification, however we understand that, but maybe there's something beyond that. And they started tinkering with a term called baptism of the Holy Spirit. And they started also wondering whether in some ways that was linked with power for service. Okay. There's many people's ministries we could talk about here. I'm going to put one guy up on the board who had a very interesting ministry, but I picked him largely because he had a strong link with Australia. This guy, John Alexander Dowie, he was actually born in Scotland and spent his early years in Australia in ministering in three different states, ministered in South Australia, Victoria, and New South Wales. And when he, by the time he died, which was 1907, it was really just after the Pentecostal movement had started, became an independent evangelist. And the key thing, one of the key things here about Dowie is that during his time in Australia, hundreds of people were not only converted to his ministry, but convinced, because there was a strong element of divine healing in his ministry, that God still moved today. So when Dowie moves on to the US, which he does, proceeds to become extremely eccentric, declares himself Elijah, and well, we won't follow the rest of the story. We'll just stay with his Australian ministry for the time being. But he left many people in Australia convinced that God moves in miraculous ways, and these people, many of them were still alive when the Pentecostal movement started. So Dowie, in a sense, ploughed the field for the Pentecostal movement in Australia, just as in America, many of his followers who became disillusioned with the direction his ministry took there later joined the Assemblies of God. Okay, finally get to the end of the 19th century, and what we can see is that both sides of the Atlantic had experienced strong moves of God, revivals, and expected God to continue moving. And Australia had seen quite a bit of that as well in different ways. They were getting used to a whole variety of different physical manifestations, particularly with divine healing becoming more prominent. In England, a chap called Edward Irving in the 1830s had a strong revival of spiritual gifts in his congregation that drew a lot of attention, not all of it positive. And increasingly, people are breaking with ecclesiastical authority. The 19th century is, without taking another tangent, as many of you would know, intellectually was a very challenging century with many different ideas coming forward. And church, people start to redefine church as a place that you go to seek tangible signs that God is alive. Okay? It's not just a place where you go to agree to something that's being taught. Okay, now we're going to jump to this guy, a guy called Charles Fox Parham. Yes, if you do research on this guy, you will find some unpleasant things, including potential links with the Ku Klux Klan, but we'll leave that to your further research. He was a key figure in the beginnings of Pentecostalism, nevertheless. So I grew up in Kansas, had a background in Methodism. You'll see that there is a distinct line going back from early Pentecostalism to the Methodist holiness movement. Did a couple of years training in theology and felt a calling to preach after being healed from this rheumatic fever. Starts off in a Methodist church, then becomes an independent minister. Was influenced by our friend Dowie in the 1890s. And starts talking with other ministers about, is God going to do something spectacular? Is it going to be a big outpouring of the Holy Spirit? Now, one of the things that intrigued Parham was, any of you have heard of the term xenolalia, which has nothing to do with Xena Warrior Princess, for those of you who are old enough to remember that show. Okay? Unfortunately, perhaps. Xenolalia, tri-xenophobia. A few of you would be familiar with that word. Okay, so the xeno bit is, I beg your pardon? Stranger or foreigner, yeah. And the lalia bit, you know, the posh name for speaking in tongues is glossolalia. Okay? So xenolalia is a specified form of speaking in tongues, which is speaking in foreign tongues that you personally don't know. So if I started speaking almost anything, really, apart from English, at the moment, then that would be xenolalia, because I don't know many other languages. Okay. Now, Parham had heard accounts of missionaries going to foreign countries and then somehow miraculously being able to speak, at least for a time, the language without having learnt it. He felt that this was a big sign of the end of the world and the second coming of Christ, which is another strong strain, the whole eschatology side of things linked with Pentecostalism that we won't really be touching on. So he believed this was a big part of what was coming just before Jesus returned and got excited by it. So he took over a building, which is an amazing building. The next slide shows this particular building. And if any of you, you know, have a building like this and want to sell it, I want to buy it. Okay. But he took over this place called Stone's Folly, started a Bible college, and had a prayer tower there. He went away for a little while and he gave his students an assignment. The assignment was, while I'm gone, study the New Testament and tell me what is the sign of the evidence in the New Testament of the presence of the Holy Spirit in people's lives. Okay, here's the building. Do any of you own something that looks like this? I want to live there. Tower of Babel. Well, Tower of Babel. More Adam's Family or Munsters or something, maybe. Okay? But unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore. Some idiot tore it down. Okay? But anyway, that's where they were. All right. Okay. So, the students, while he was gone, did that study, did that assignment, and decided that they believed that glossolalia, or speaking in tongues, was the New Testament evidence. And then they began praying for it. Now, this next event is usually what's seen as the beginning of the modern Pentecostal movement, when on the 1st of January 1901, someone called Agnes Osman starts speaking in tongues. Apparently could speak nothing else for 3 days. Chinese, xenolalia, apparently. So I often think, you know, of poor Agnes saying, please can I have a hamburger, I'm hungry. And no one understands what she's saying. Okay. The interesting thing was that she then, and this is being a little bit facetious here, this is not historic, right? She then writes down, please can I have a hamburger? But she is writing in Chinese, which would be xenographia. Hello, question? Ah, good question, and one I've often thought. There were, by this time, there were Chinese people around. There was a Chinese presence, for example, on the Californian gold fields. So presumably, do I know if they actually brought a Chinese person in there? I haven't researched that to that degree. But anyway, there you go. But if she was writing Chinese, then presumably there's some evidence they could take to somebody afterwards. Anyway, either way, it was hard talking to Agnes for a period of time. Okay, and then the group, you can see the other students followed on in that. The group goes to Kansas, and then there's this large revival, and suddenly thousands of people are involved. Here's a picture of Agnes in a minute. Hello. Come back to Houston in a second. There she is. Okay. So they move on to Houston. Parham opens another Bible college, and we enter something called what could be called the second phase, if you like, of the Pentecostal movement, with a guy called William Seymour. And William Seymour was a black guy, descended from slaves, blind in one eye. And now you can imagine that we're talking the very early 20th century. We're talking Texas, which is south. We're talking being descended from slaves. We're talking being blind. This guy's not necessarily going to be welcome in all circles. Okay. Now Seymour had previous experience pastoring a church, and because it's when and where it is, and because Seymour's black, he can't sit in the same classroom with white people. Right. So he's out in the corridor listening to the sermon. Or the teaching, while Parham's teaching on this, and he believes it. Okay, he thinks, they're speaking in tongues, thing. Yeah, okay, sounds like it might be true. Now, while Seymour's sitting out in the corridor listening to this message, he gets a message on his iPhone, or however you got messages back then. I don't know what they did, asking him to come and pastor a church in Los Angeles. Okay, so he does. Now, the first sermon he preaches when he goes to Los Angeles is this last message he heard in Houston about being filled with the Spirit and speaking in tongues, and so they throw him out of the church. Okay? They didn't, not a particularly popular message. And he's not himself speaking in tongues. So he's preaching something, preaching about an experience that he's not shared at this point. Thrown out of the church. Not a really good start. But, as you can see, continues holding meetings in a private home. Later on, he does start speaking in tongues, as do others. And we're about to move on to a key event. Here's a picture of Seymour. He used to incidentally preach. If I preached something like Seymour preached, I'd be on my knees with my head under this table. And you wouldn't be able to see me. Okay, so he'd basically stick his head in a packing crate half the time to preach, because he did not want the attention on him. Okay, they moved to a place called Azusa Street, and this is this name has become fairly famous. It's linked with the beginnings of Pentecostalism. It's an old warehouse, very, very plain. And in Azusa Street, I don't know if you guys feel like there's often lots of activity levels in church, lots of meetings, these guys, when they move in, they actually have services three times a day, 7 days a week. They cram 1,000 people into that building, I'm sure, contravene every OHS regulation that existed at the time. And astonishingly, for that particular period, the division between the different ethnic backgrounds suddenly didn't matter, and led people to say, look, the colour line has been washed away in blood. So something was achieved there that has perhaps seldom been achieved for quite some time since. And perhaps even more scandalously, there you go, women in ministry. Well, that's been there actually at times of revival throughout church history, but certainly was prominent as Azusa Street. They renamed it the Apostolic Faith Mission. They didn't use musical instruments. A cappella was the way they went with their church music. And you had some people... I noticed you didn't have any synchronised shouters today in the service. Okay, perhaps next time. People often shouted throughout the meetings. And, I guess it's something if you attend a Pentecostal or charismatic church today, you'll find perhaps a little bit of background noise going on. The pews were planks. As I said, Seymour had his head inside the box a lot of the time. And the preaching was spontaneous. So in other words, it wasn't necessarily prepared in advance. Okay. Lots of altar calls. All right, now I'm going to skip quickly over the next couple of slides, but they'll be put up later on for you to look at. There's lots of reports, contemporary newspaper reports. That's from the LA Times, people saying, no, don't like this at all. Then from people in the movement saying, we think this is from God, this is really exciting. Okay, so that began the Pentecostal movement. And you had Vincent Sinan, who's probably the premier Pentecostal historian, said that really, if you like, Azusa Street became the first Pentecostal tourism hotspot. People went from all over the world to Azusa Street to experience what was going on. They then went back to their own hometowns. There's one fantastic story, which I think we're ahead of time, so I might just indulge myself a bit here. There's a guy called Thomas Barrett from Norway. Thomas Barrett had come to New York on a fundraising expedition for his church. He had been a total failure and raised no money. But he was in New York at the time the Azusa Street revival was starting to occur. Because he'd totally failed in his fundraising expedition, he had no money to cross the continent to go to see what was happening. So what he did was he wrote a letter to Azusa Street and said, what's going on? I hear God's doing amazing things. Tell me what's going on. So they sent a letter back. I sometimes joke in history classes, this was, an extremely influential postage stamp. Okay. So they tell Barrett what's happening, and he thinks, this is brilliant. He never gets to Azusa Street. So he goes back to Oslo. He says, hey, guess what? I've been a total failure as a fundraiser. But there's this amazing new thing that God seems to be doing. That led to the spread of the Pentecostal message, not just through all of Scandinavia, but also through Britain. Because there was a guy in the northern part of Britain called Alexander Boddy. And Alexander Boddy was hearing what was going on in Azusa Street and was thinking of travelling from England to Azusa Street to check it out. When he found out what Thomas Barrett was doing in Scandinavia, he thought, oh, this is a bit closer. I'll just get Barrett down here, which is what he did. And that led to the beginnings of the Pentecostal movement in Britain. So from one postage stamp and then... people linked with that congregation in Britain, some of you may have heard of a guy called Smith Wigglesworth, who was actually laid hands on by Alexander Boddy's wife and then went on to have a very influential, not to say confrontational, Pentecostal ministry. If you wanted to be prayed for by Smith Wigglesworth, you were likely to get punched in the stomach. And so had a slightly different take on laying on of hands. but very, very influential, but great story from one postage stamp, the influences of Azusa Street on all the Scandinavias and Britain and beyond. One postage stamp from Azusa Street. So Simon says virtually every Pentecostal denomination in the world can trace its origins one way or another to Azusa Street. Okay, so let's say we're in the 1920s, we've got some Pentecostal denominations emerging, and everyone is pretty much dividing into Pentecostal and non-Pentecostal camps. The non-Pentecostals regard the Pentecostals as basically carriers of a spiritual bubonic plague, and they're going to stay as far away from them as possible. They're never going to go into a Pentecostal church. And so it's very much a polemical situation, accusations. Pentecostals are saying, you guys don't have the Holy Spirit, and the other camp is saying, you guys are either demon-possessed or victims of mass hysteria. There's not much sort of ecumenical spirit going on there at all. So that's the way things started for a while, until we get into the period between the wars, say 1930s, 1940s, and what happens there is that we have a number of independent ministries springing up who are essentially Pentecostal in theology, but are looking at having their meetings in places that are not just Pentecostal churches. So we see people having meetings in tents, having meetings in rented halls that are seen as neutral ground. People like Oral Roberts and others. Healing's often at the forefront. So if you've got a serious illness, you think, well, I'd like to be healed. The doctors say I'm going to die, but I'm not going to a Pentecostal church. But I might go to a tent. I might let someone pray for me in a tent, you know. And so there's this middle ground, if you like, that taps into a long-standing tradition of camp meetings, etc. And also, in a sense, reminds Pentecostals that they don't necessarily have a mortgage on the power of God operating within their own four walls. Through the 1950s, a number of people in established churches are experiencing some of these Pentecostal manifestations, but it stays very low-key. 1950s also see an organisation called the Full Gospel Businessmen's Association, started by a guy called Demos Shikarian, where businessmen would meet for lunch or for breakfast or whatever, and again, a neutral ground, but essentially sharing Pentecostal experience. That's just a picture from that era. Large tent you might see there without any walls on the side of it. Okay, so we're going to move quickly to the charismatic movement. Theologically, what the Pentecostals tended to believe as a distinctive was something called the baptism with the Holy Spirit, speaking with tongues being the initial evidence of that. And that tended to be a point of, certainly a point of difference between them and anybody else. It also enabled them to, non-Pentecostals, to characterise Pentecostals as people who were usually either black, female, white trash, uneducated, poor, and completely relegate them to that category or categories. Okay. Suddenly something happens called the charismatic movement. And a guy called Dennis Bennett, who was an Episcopalian, American Anglican, begins to speak with tongues. Now, this is, you know, in itself not necessarily too much of a landmark event. He tells his congregation, and they kick him out. Well, that's pretty much par for the course as well. But what's different here is that two members of Bennett's congregation independently share this with the two most influential magazines in America, Time and Newsweek, who both cover it as a front page story. And suddenly it becomes news right across the United States, and therefore a huge topic of conversation. Now, this means that people are suddenly going to have to start to recalibrate their images of who it is. These sort of derogatory pigeonholing of people in certain demographics if they lined up with Pentecostal phenomena. Something's about to explode in the kitchen. Okay. For those of you who are listening to this later. Okay. I've obviously gone over time. So Dennis Bennett is... shares his experience openly, they run the stories, and suddenly this gets a credibility and a respectability, this whole movement. that means people have to look at it somewhat differently. There's a picture of him. Okay, so the charismatic movement. This is a movement of people across all established denominations with these gifts of the Spirit. Now, intriguingly, you would expect that the Pentecostals, those who fought hard for this particular message, would say, this is brilliant. God's doing something new. Wow. No, they hated this, to make a sweeping generalisation. They particularly hated it when they realised, well, this can't be God, because he wouldn't be dealing with Roman Catholics, for a start. Okay? So it was a total head spin for them, really. A little bit of territoriality. We've fought long and hard. We've been persecuted. We've been called all these names for years. You know, we've fought for this. What is God doing? This can't be God, you know. So they were less than welcoming, let's say, of the charismatic movement. The denominations that the charismatic movement started to turn up in had theologies that were very different to the classic Pentecostals. I'll come back to that term, classic Pentecostals, in a minute. And generally not open to this idea of glossolalia and initial evidence. So it became both an affirmation but also a challenge to Pentecostalism. And the term charismatic movement, in the way we're using it at the moment, first turns up in 1963. Okay, so some of the implications of this. Firstly, the Pentecostals found that their theology was being challenged by those who had more theological education in many ways. This brought much sharper focus to Pentecostal theology and really forced it to come of age. But on the other hand, members of the traditional denominations found that the Pentecostals might have something to offer after all. Next point I've already made. Demographic pigeonholing of people who may demonstrate some of these gifts started to break down. But unfortunately, we see lots of lawyers did well out of this. Okay, churches split, property disputes, all of that sort of stuff happened. Okay, so let's quickly, as we wind this up, look at some of the implications here. While there were lots of reservations, perhaps, about some of the things going on, pastors tended to notice, some of the people who are inclined in this charismatic direction actually seem to be some of the more committed members of my congregation. Pastors seldom want to cut those people loose for some reason. Okay. Also, it led to an avalanche of lay activism in churches. We made the point in the earlier slide that the evangelical movement and the revivals had really got people used to the fact that God didn't necessarily just move with ordained clergy within certain four walls. This took it another direction. Obviously, contemporary Christian music, which you may or may not be wildly excited about some aspects of. Nevertheless, this was one of the things that certainly got a great deal of impetus from the charismatic movement. Also, its trans-denominational nature meant that there was some sort of organic unity going on that crossed denominational boundaries. And essentially, by the 1970s, a lot of denominations had got to a point where they had at least a stance of cautious openness to what was going on in this area. All right, last two slides. Firstly, some terminology. Some of it you'll be familiar with. We tend to often use in everyday speech Pentecostal and charismatic as synonymous, but wanting to just draw a couple of boundary lines here, if I may. Vincent Sinan's definition of classical Pentecostalism is somebody who theologically holds to the position of speaking in tongues being evidenced by, being baptism of the Holy Spirit being evidenced by speaking with tongues, but also denominationally belonging to a Pentecostal denomination that was formed before 1940. So fairly descriptive, prescriptive. One of the reasons for that is that interwar thing I talked about earlier. So in other words, if you were part of one of those early Pentecostal denominations, you were part of the pioneer generation, if you like. Okay. The charismatic, we've really talked about, that's people who are open to spiritual gifts but within the more established traditional denominations. We tend not to use the term neo-Pentecostalism much in Australia at all. It's quite a useful term, though. Really, it's people who hold to that doctrine about initial evidence, but belong to a later group, if you like. Neo-charismatic, sometimes also the third wave. Often John Wimber and the Vineyard churches are linked with this predominantly. But this is people who don't fit into, often independent congregations, don't fit into any of the other groups. Renewal is a nice grab bag to shove them all in. Okay, which is when you're doing statistics, which is our final slide, is quite useful. Okay, so Pentecostal, charismatic, renewal, whatever, the majority of the world's mega churches, so there are mega churches, 50,000 plus. I think the biggest church in the world is around about 800,000 members. Must take up a while. Do a while to take up the offering, I suppose. Disproportionately large media presence amongst these churches. Above average financial support. Over one third of all full-time Christian ministers are in this renewal area, active in over 80% of the world's largest cities. As of last year, 631 million people in this category, about 25% of the world's Christians, up substantially from 1970. And the estimate is 800 million by 2025. So I guess regardless of where you find yourself on the spectrum in terms of Pentecostal, charismatic, renewal, neo-Penti, neo-charismatic, whatever you find yourself as, or completely non, what we're dealing with here is a phenomenon that has substantially impacted the church that we live in today, and is going to continue to do so. Any questions? So, have I fulfilled my promise to be both presumptuous and superficial? Thank you. Thank you. Okay, well, yes. Surprisingly, I think it... Yes, I will repeat the question. So the question was about the location of those megachurches. The couple that are at the top of the list, I believe, are in South Korea. Yes, and... yes, I do. The question was, how did the charismatic movement get into the Catholic Church? The quick way into that is to say that it started with prayer meetings and became conferences. And the Catholic charismatic conferences got so large by the 1970s that they stopped having them in one location. They got to 30,000 plus by the 1970s and then just basically started hiving them out. Obviously, it's not irrelevant that the charismatic movement generally starts around the time of Vatican II, where they've got an openness to greater participation of the laity in the Catholic Church anyway. So there's more momentum into it from there as well.
I probably don't need the microphone.
No, it's going to be recorded.
Thank you. I just wanted to make the comment that my great-grandfather's brother followed Dowie to the shores of one of the lakes, I can't remember now, it was outside Chicago.
Yes.
To the church there, and... his sister, who was known in the family as Auntie May, visited him there and reported that in the foyer of the church there were lots of crutches and things like that, because apparently they went in for faith healing.
Mm, indeed.
But his successor was a man called Bolivar, who was a little bit crazy and thought he could see across Lake Michigan, whatever the lake was that they were on.
Okay, thanks for that. No diaries passed down in the family by any chance?
Most of the family diaries are the one kept.
Okay. Okay. Well, if you ever stumble across any of those diaries, you know, primary sources are pretty much valuable to historians. So I'd love to see them.
Peter, yes. You were very generous in not commenting at all on whether the things that they said were happening were actually evidence of the Spirit or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it just occurs to me, I mean, it's the elephant in the room, I guess.
Okay.
Do you want about your risk of personal
comment? Yeah, I'll give you a very unequivocal answer, yes and no. Look, I think from looking at times of revival generally, I had to write some years ago the life story of a missionary in Borneo, and that got me up close to some sources there. I think it's always a very mixed bag in times of revival. I think there's things that are genuine going on, there's things that are fleshly going on, and there's all sorts of other things going on. And I don't necessarily, I don't believe at all that is a reason to oppose times of revival. I think if you were to oppose that, we'd need to close down probably this church and every other one. Okay? Because whether it's a time of revival or a time of a alleged move of the Spirit or whatever, let's face it, the church has only mirrored whatever might be going on in that to some degree. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Throughout the last two millennia. I think it's just an intensification. Yes. Sure. Okay, so you're speaking in tongues, still an emphasis. I've discovered that it's changing. In the way that the classic Penty understanding of the doctrine was taught. So if you look up... And, of course, the fact everyone's changing their name anyway, so, you know, you're all... It's all Australian Council of Churches or not Assemblies of God, you know. So everyone's going sort of undercover, if you like. But if you looked up the standard Assembly of God statement of faith, it would still have that classic statement of initial evidence. Having taught for about 18 years in a Pentecostal Bible college, I would often ask my students this... very question. And I discovered that increasingly most students were not rigid about that. So did they still believe in speaking of tongues? Yes. Did all of them speak in tongues? Not necessarily. And did they... I think this is an influence of what's called the third wave or the neo-charismatics. People have rethought their theology and remain open to the variety of gifts, but not necessarily hanging the hat on any one and saying, if you've got this, you've got it. If you don't, you don't. So that's the trend I've seen out there, even though in black and white, it's still there.
So it could be more of a style of worship, even that people might be attracted to the
teacher,
rather than
spiritual signs
that are part of any.
Absolutely. I'm sure.